Ben Selko set out to make a documentary about a legendary basketball court in Greenwich Village, but what he ended up with was a film about a very unusual subject named Sam. In A Summer in the Cage, Mr. Selko tackles issues like mental illness and the ethics of being a documentary filmmaker. The film airs tonight at 9 on the Sundance Channel, and it brings Ben Selko to the show. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
When did you meet Sam, and what was your first impression?
It was 2000. I just started out making the documentary about the cage in Greenwich Village, and I was one of the few white players down there and people down there, so I was trying to make my way into the community. And he, he's 6'7" and white and a very good basketball player, very charming. So he was initially an anomaly there as well. But what did it is that he had these photographs that of the players that he'd been taking there for years and sharing with them. And I saw that, and that looked to me like another window, another element to add to the film. And that moved me first about him.
And you thought that he might be the focal point, and then he got more and more involved. He offered to help produce.
I didn't think he'd be the focal point. I actually wanted to keep him as a periphery in terms of a subject, but I wanted to use his photos. I thought it'd be another texture to the film. And then, as things, he came on as a kind of partner pretty early on, but very quickly things started to unravel for him and him having his first manic break. And that created a lot of creative tension between us, and then, really had to flip the whole film on its head.
So the film, which was a look at very competitive games in that these mostly black basketball players play in that Greenwich Village playground, most of us have passed by and seen it. It looks almost like the pro game at times, became something else. And then Sam wanted to make it into a film with political purposes.
As we started very quickly, I think
alarm bells must have gone off.
It was interesting. I look back and think, what was I thinking? I mean, all the signs are right there on the wall, but working 16, 17 hours a day, over my head, first documentary, and he was someone at that time who was very charismatic and very enthusiastic. So I was compelled by his energy. It was propelling me. And quite honestly, we're both basketball players. We're both very competitive. There was a competition of who could introduce more energy and kind of passion to the project. So I was going to put aside any kind of small, tangential thoughts and stay with him on the passion for the project, just in general.
So he was enthusiastic about promoting Bill Bradley and Colin Powell as an electoral team in the next presidential election. And then he sabotaged your documentary about the cage.
I think, and it sabotaged in the sense of, he eroded the trust of our characters. It wasn't an intentional thing. He didn't realize he was doing it. What was going on was, within his delusions and his, mania, he would be up all hours of night writing emails, trying to, create, a much larger film out of this and, garner national attention. So he was reaching out to artists, with these kind of delusional political ideas. But my name was on the project. Players from the court were on the project. And then he was passing out these pamphlets. Some of the guys got there, and in the street, you just don't, you make sure you have your facts right about people, and that created a lot of tension and eroded a lot of trust there.
When did you start worrying that he might have problems with mental illness?
I was pretty concerned, about a month after it. I realized he wasn't sleeping, phone calls, 15, 20 times a day, the agitation, things like that. And I didn't know him before that day. I didn't have a context for who he was, so I started to get a sense from his friends of, is this within his range? Is this within who he is? And it became pretty clear that something was going on. I didn't have an idea that it was manic depression or bipolar disorder at the time. But
had he already been diagnosed with it?
No, this was all pre-diagnosis. What I learned later was that his father was also diagnosed with it and had, years of issues with it. So it was a history, but I didn't know it at the time.
So he's admitted to a psychiatric hospital, and you decide that maybe you'll switch subjects and make it about him and his problems, his mental problems.
And that was a slow process. It was a slow process. That was a lot of responsibility to take on. I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. I was still hoping to kind of, retain some of the elements of the street basketball film. But I thought, here's, an opportunity. Let's just see what happens. Well, and I thought we'd make a short film about a really strange summer. But the second time he came back, things continued to get weirder.
Now, bipolar disorder is not all that uncommon. I guess it's 1 in 100. But he seems to be rather extreme.
No, I don't think he's actually extreme. I think he's probably more classic, if anything. You know, I think, you know, there's a spectrum of mood disorders in terms of the severity of the symptoms and the manifestations of it, and it's anywhere from 1 to 5% of the population that's diagnosed. He exhibits a lot of classic symptoms, you know, going through cycles of extreme elevation and mania, often needing hospitalization, taking himself off his meds, and then followed by a prolonged depression.
We have a clip of him explaining what it's like for him, the mania.
When you're manic, it's the most wonderful feeling you have in your entire life. Like, I feel better now than I felt then, but it's like a drug. You feel like, I refer to it as ecstasy. It's like that, but better, because it goes on for days or weeks.
And that's when you started to question your role as director. What did you feel that you were, as you say in the film, leading the way for Sam's illness to overcome him?
I feel like that day, we were trying to recall the events of 2000, you know, and he was definitely in a heightened state. And, you know, in mania, you know, your sense of being gets aggrandized. Take on these messianic qualities and complexes. And, you know, he's always been intrigued by celebrity. And so I think in the end of the day, me filming him contributed. Every kind of coincidence, every kind of serendipitous event, it helps, you know, inform, you know, and rationalize the events of your mania, of your delusions. And I think in the end of the day, I was contributing to that. And the end of the day, I turned the camera off and spent several more dramatic days without filming him, just trying to maintain him, trying to get him into care. But
he went back to California and you accompanied him. And to some degree, you seemed to be his only connection to reality.
In two ways. I mean, I at that point he was in New York, his family was in California, and he was staying with me, and I didn't trust him to be on his own. He's 6'7", 300 pounds. You know, his gestures, his enthusiasm could easily be mistook, certainly with anyone around law enforcement. And certainly at that time, this was right after 9/11, you know, I was really trepidatious about him getting on a plane, you know, talking about God the way he was talking about God, about being moved by, you know, events in the world. And he's a very liberal guy from Berkeley, California. So those views, you know, right after 9/11 on a plane, that wasn't going to meld well.
You and Sam both wanted a happy ending for the film, but did that mean the same thing for each of you?
I mean, I think we set out with absolutely the same intent. We thought, you know, here's a guy who had the world was his oyster for years, and, you know, why would this challenge present anything else that he couldn't conquer? And, you know, it humbled both of us very quickly.
Well, for a long time, he wanted to be the subject of the film, and then his attitude changed.
I think, you know, he thought he was going to be a model of successfully managing this illness very quickly. And it's an illness that can be quite devastating, and, you know, it's evidenced in part in the film, but it also, you know, it's something he's struggled with, and it's something he's continued to struggle with. What I hope he sees in the film is that the courage he exhibited by putting himself out there, that, you know, he's not a failure, he's not someone who's been, you know, taken to his knees by this disease forever, but he's still in the middle of a battle.
Well, you say you hope that he sees it. You told me that he hasn't seen the film yet.
He hasn't seen it yet. No, his family has seen it. His mom, Sharon, and sister Shelley have both seen it, have been very supportive of it. You know, they take it, as I do, that, you know, in the community and mental health world and in the community at large, it can educate and open up some minds, but still all of us worry, you know, is that worth the price for him, how he views himself in the film? And that's a concern, for sure.
Well, he gets angrier and angrier, and he feels you've betrayed him. He starts blaming you for his problems, and this is a big guy. You might have even felt that you were at risk.
Earlier, what's not in the film, earlier that day, we had met in person. And, you know, he was out of money. I'd given him some money to help him the last few days in New York. And when he wanted more from me, and he had an idea for a concept for the end of the film, he wanted us to go down to Ground Zero at 7 in the morning, and he had an idea. It was right during the World Cup. And I didn't do it. I knew that my experience before with the camera was not going to help the situation. And he was, you know, he was definitely frustrated and agitated. But this is someone who hasn't been sleeping in 3 or 4 days. You know, and it was 100 degrees in July. It was, you know, a confluence of events exacerbated by the mania.
Well, there are the ethical concerns. At a certain point, he's accusing you of using him, and you must have asked yourself whether you were. When do you turn off the camera and something like this and allow a man to have his own private hell?
You know, we endeavored on it together, and in, you know, we made a pact without caveat that if we're going to do this, then there is no turning off the camera. And that was something we, you know, engendered and enjoined together in the beginning. Circumstances dictated differently down the end. I don't know if I have the answer of when to turn off the camera, because like I said before, there's a greater good that I hope will happen out of this. I've already had a lot of very positive feedback. It has provided community for people who have mental illness, you know, but the price that will be paid for him is yet to be determined. And that, you know, that is, you know, that's the balance that's weighing right here.
And now you have to make other films and hope that they don't take over your life.
Well, I think this business, you know, can't they do anyway. There's nothing you can do about it.
A Summer in the Cage makes its world premiere on the Sundance Channel and Cable tonight at 9 p.m. My great thanks to filmmaker Ben Selko for talking about it with us.
Thanks very much. There'll be encore airings as well. Check the website www.cagethemovie.com. Thank you.